Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name's Alan Pettingill of Brit Talk Live, and I'm lucky enough today to have Nick Helm, a friend of mine, an engineer who has been in the game for quite a long time. He's involved in investigation, forensics, and different things. And we cross the line in that one is parking garages, and I do a lot of historic buildings. So, Nick, would you like to introduce yourself a little bit more to the audience?
Yeah, Alan, thank you so much for taking the time to have me out. So yeah, my name is Nick Heim. My background is in structural engineering. Today, most of my work is in innovation. My job title is senior innovation engineer. And what we focus on primarily, like Alan alluded to, is parking structure restoration and repair. So what I essentially do is I'm the guy that focuses on working with our business leaders to, you know, basically put the business on a rocket ship and expedite what we're doing today as much as possible, trying to reach those business objectives through innovation, which sometimes includes technology, and sometimes it's just good old fashioned process. So I think there's a lot of good stuff we're going to talk about today, Alan. And yeah, just thank you again so much for having me on.
Yeah, one of the things that we were discussing earlier, just before we came online, was that I'm lucky in my life that I've had some great mentors. And when I was in the UK, I started off with cavity wall tie replacement, an investigation for remediation of wall ties. And then from there, I expanded into specialized anchors on historic buildings. One of the oldest buildings that I've worked on is 2,000 years old, built by the Romans in York Wall in England. And from there, we learned how to do specialized anchors. And then when I came over here, I realized there was a need for anchors, especially on historic buildings and structures, same as yourself. Mm-hmm. In parking structures, when we've had corrosion and things like that, we certainly need to share that knowledge. But as I said, to get back to the mentoring, I was lucky because when I was in the UK, I worked with some of the best. I worked with a guy called Brian Hindle, and he taught me how about cavity wall ties, corrosion, the problems, and then we moved into specialized anchors. It wasn't until I came to America that I was lucky enough to have met a professor called Professor Tom Grimm from UT, who had wrote lots of papers and directed me to the Masonry Society. And the reason I'm mentioning the Masonry Society is that I was lucky enough that when I got in there, I acquired quite a few mentors. Now, I'm coming up to 65, so I'm looking forward down the line with a friend of mine, Gillian Lancaster, who helps me with the magazine, to try and push out and share as much knowledge as we can, so that I didn't realize that as the older I get, I'm becoming a mentor. And then I was laughing because, like with you, you've been in engineering for long enough that you've had some great mentors, but you're getting into that realm now where I've noticed on LinkedIn where you're becoming quite a mentor as well. So I just let's just saying about with yourself, Nick, what do you think about with the mentoring? Because you've had some great people around you as well.
Absolutely, Alan. Yeah, and Gillian, thank you so much for, you know, taking the time to help us out and kind of pushing the message out there. But Alan, answer your question. So in like a role like mine, it's like technology and innovation is a big focus. That doesn't mean you lose sight of the way the business runs, right? Or the people that are involved. And I like to kind of think of it as two tracks. So there's the things that, like experience, right? You don't just suddenly shortcut and get 30 years experience overnight. That's just, it just doesn't happen, right? So I've been fortunate enough to have a number of great mentors throughout my career that have been able to teach me what they know through their 30, 35, 40 plus years of experience in the business, right? And what I'd like to believe I've provided in return is this kind of reverse mentoring where, let me give you an example of like writing a report where I've got one of my guys who's been a great mentor to me. He's been he's like, hey, this thing is taking me days. And I'm like, well, if we do it this way, boom, it's done in a matter of minutes, right? And think about everything that he now has the time to teach me because he's no longer bogged down with that one specific. I can give you, a dozen or more examples on that. All that to say, there's the timeless lessons and the classic wisdom that, we just don't pick up overnight. And then there's a real opportunity for the mentee to then provide value to the mentor in these relationships. And that's worked really well for me.
Yeah, I think that's really good. And I think that nowadays, young engineers are certainly more adept to using the things around them, especially technology, AI, and things like that. Whereas, as I was saying, it's funny that when I was younger, when I first started looking at buildings, I had a pen, a paper, and a clipboard, and I was looking up at the building. Never did I think that we'd be looking at buildings in 3D clear. And some of the new software that's been adapted to show that we still have defects. And I think that that's a good thing and a bad thing, really, because we can get so much overload as well, because there's different levels of education that most people come in with. Certain people have certain skill sets, and I think that the AI is certainly accelerating different levels of it, and it's still hard for the professional and the contractor to catch up and keep that balance with the AI and the technology, the drones, the flares, and everything that we're getting nowadays to combine that in. And it's going to be interesting to see how the models change down the road for teaching, especially teaching for restoration. Will there be 3D model images that will help EITs and engineers and the people at the end of it receiving, being able to see it more in 3D, how the systems work? Because a lot of times in the past, we used to get reports from engineers, which the contractor had to interpret. But nowadays, we can get a drone view, we can get a closer up view, we can get different images and things like this that can be put out.
Yeah, and you're spot on, Alan. And I think to this example, right, like we like to call it recognizable reality. So think of your client, for example. Do they really know what's going on with 2D drawings or I mean, for the more sophisticated ones, I think they can get into the details, but for the most part, it's our job to just distill down, you know, what's the problem? How do I remediate it? And how much is it going to cost and how long is it going to take, right? And I think for the younger engineers, there's some of that because they're coming in for the most part as lay people trying to learn business. So let me give you an example. Would it help an EIT to have a 3D model of a wall cavity and understanding how the wall ties between the backup and the exterior portion of the wall actually interact, right? What's the spacing? What's the detailing in 3D about how these things are actually built? You know what I mean? And I think there's a place for both because today the industry isn't equipped to hand over, let's say, a 3D model as part of a restoration project. We're just not there yet. But can the tool still be used to help all parties understand what's going on? I think so.
Yeah. And the thing is that we still can't, I know that the tech's accelerating so fast, but we've still got the old school. And it was funny, I wrote an article a while ago, me and Jill, about the Sons of Masonry and how an old bricklayer told me this, Joe Curry one time, wonderful man, a very experienced bricklayer and contractor. And I said to him, I said, so what do you make of all of this with the older crew leaving? He said, Alan, he says, I'll tell you where it went a bit wrong was when it was COVID. When the COVID was on, we all the builders, bricklayers, the seasoned in the ways, they're used to getting up in the morning, going out, their bodies were set to do that physical labor and things. But as he said, I was 6'2" when the COVID hit. And then for 2 years, we were grounded. We couldn't go anywhere and couldn't do anything. And then all of a sudden, after that 3 years, oh, red light, green light, go. Let's get back into it. And as he said, a lot of the older boys that were getting back out there realized just where the aches and pains were coming from. So we're starting to find a lot of people certainly retiring. But if you had 100 people retire, it's only a small amount of people that are now coming in to the industry that are filling those positions and learning. So we're definitely having a short stock on wisdom, knowledge, and repairs because we haven't got the people to train them. And I think that that's another big one that I'm an advocate for, is certainly training. I think that there needs to be more training between a contractor and engineer down the line, and it won't hurt, and also architects as well, because it takes a team for us to be able to work together to get all this done. As you know, it's not just looking at the building, it's coming up with the repair strategy, how to get people there, the inconvenience of the building, the anchor system, the cost, everything. It's quite stressful in our game, actually, from engineer, contractor as well, and architect.
And everybody has, right, different objectives that all go towards the same goal. And Alan, to your point, actually, this isn't the first time, you know, I've talked about this type of case in particular. So I just, on my podcast, we recently published an interview with Kevin Wastey, who's the CEO of a local surveying firm here in the Cleveland area. And he goes on to explain on the episode the shortage of surveyors, right? It was the same idea. You know, these guys and girls are ending, you know, getting near retirement. There's not enough people coming in to be trained, which really created a shortage of surveyors throughout the country. Well, actually what happened was surveying wages like shot up, right? And now they're starting to see those individuals coming into surveying programs, going through the ranks, getting training, and starting to replace the experienced people who are now retiring, right? There's a couple of, I think, like nuanced differences here, though. One being that these survey crews, through the advent of technology, were actually able to be a lot smaller, so you don't have to backfill all professionals that are leaving just because of some of the advances in technology, which doesn't replace the knowledge that these people have. It just makes it so that some of these tedious tasks are replaced by technology, right? But it's the same cycle. It's a renewed interest in industry, in this case, because of, you know, economic incentives. But does the masonry industry have kind of like a similar revitalization? I mean, anything's possible, right? The big thing that I see is that it's not for a lot, right? These masons and bricklayers to start bringing robotics to place certain tasks like the surveying industry did, right? I was looking at a humanoid robot yesterday. I think it's going to be some time before that happens, but that's not going to replace the deep industry knowledge that these people have. So whatever way you slice it, man, these masons that are nearing retirement, like, incredibly important to like what the industry does. And I know I wouldn't let anyone else tell you otherwise.
But it's interesting because when you said about, as you said, the masonry industry, and you deal with parking garages and things like that that are concrete. Now, there's an interesting one that I've been following was the collapse of the apartments in Miami. And one of the things that was an interesting article today was saying about how the elderly and the poor are going to get hit because of the inspection fees and maintenance fees on these condos down the line. And it's funny because one time before, I'll give you an example. I went on a job one time where a bridge had been hit, and when it had been hit, it had knocked off and showed the corrosion and the spalling. And I said, and the engineer straight out said, "There we go, we're going to cut that back, we're going to fix the rebar, we're going to patch it back up." And I said, "But what about the masonry to the left?" He said, "No, it looks fine." I said, "But it's the same age." He said, "No, it's fine." And that was it. And I started laughing. I thought to myself, there is a big difference between masonry men and concrete men.
And that's, you know, that's another thing. So I had this conversation the other day. Was, "You're an expert in this." And I'm like, I consider myself an expert in like one thing that's like a cross between two or three different niches, right? And I would say, like, just because I know a decent amount about concrete, wouldn't consider myself an expert. Masonry and the building envelope, that's a completely different field of study, right? So knowing when to stay in your lane and knowing your limitations, I think, is also really important.
It is. And it's going to be interesting to see how investigations do change down the line. The insurance companies are already looking at roofs and things like that and determining from satellite that they have problems. I wonder how far the insurance company will go on historic buildings down the line, because they'll be able to take videos and things like that. Because one of the things I'm coming back to is that the laws changed in New York for parapet walls, and the inspections were delayed big time because of people in COVID and finding it hard to find people experienced enough to go and investigate a lot of these problems. It certainly is going to be interesting to see how the inspection details and requirements will be required within the next 5 years, because the Masonry Society is certainly working on codes for changing masonry. And I know that there's codes been changed as well for concrete. So it'll be interesting for me and you to see where all that goes. One of the things is that as well, when we're talking about tech, one of the things that intrigues me is the ground penetrating radar. It's not for an everyday person to sit down and get hold of and use, but it certainly starting to give us a lot more images on these structures to make more of assessment. How do you feel as an engineer?
Like, they're great tools, but like any piece of technology, they're a tool, and it's the user that ultimately, the user of either the technology or of the data that it produces, that makes value out of it, right? Because for ground penetrating radar, for example, you can get all of these different types of data out, right? And if you have like a line scan, for example, right? Like, go show that to my wife, doesn't mean anything to her, but in the hands of the right practitioner, right? It's so we use, so ground penetrating radar, I would say as an application, is most well known for, let's say, locating either interior to like concrete or subsurface below the ground objects, right? So it could be utilities, it could be forcing steel, it could be stainless steel wall ties, right? But the point is you're trying to, it's basically, you know, put an x-ray goggles on to see into whatever you're interested in. Now, x-ray is that's a technical term, but the idea is, I think, still there.
I will, to be honest with you, Nick, I think that the technology coming the way that it is down the line, once we're able to see what's behind the brick curtain, you might say, behind the brick wall, I think that the game is going to change totally in the fact that once we can see through a brick, that if we can see blocked weeples around, that's going to change things. And one of the things for me is that I'm waiting for the technology that I can find a stud, wooden stud and steel stud through the brick wall with clarity, so that then remediation of cavity wall ties can take place. And I'm not just on about just myself, but there's a whole industry of manufacturers out there waiting for this as well to come about, that will be able to change, game changing down the line. Because once that's changed, and then it'll slowly come about that we will be able to start repairing buildings and seeing arches, things like that. One of the big things that I deal with on historic buildings is with corrosion is steel lintels. Wooden lintels are a big one as well. But certainly, I think, what was it? 360 odd million a year on corrosion problems in America. And the structures, you think that nowadays with the technology, they'd be able to put a wire in the end and be able to connect them together to stop it, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and so there are certain techniques we use, concrete restoration, so bottom protection being one of them, to prevent the issue. Have you heard of non-metallic reinforcing that come across?
Yeah, FRP, the fiber reinforced plastic and the rebar things. Yeah, I think that's a great idea, definitely.
Now, it's kind of drawing a parallel to software, right? It's never the thing that, like, we can technically prove a piece of software product will work, right? Mm. It's getting the thousands of engineers and specifiers pumped, right? And that's not a knock on them. It's, you know, they're in charge of their projects, right? They're signing, sealing, and they just need a certain level of comfort where they say, yeah, I'm comfortable with this product, right? So here's an example. It's like, why don't we just use non-metallic reinforcing steel in all of our new projects, right?
Yeah, I'm all for it.
Right? Like, my understanding, and, you know, I could be convinced otherwise, is that cost is comparable to steel reinforcing. There are codes and standards that guide engineers how to use, right? But then communicating all that information and then dictating change in an industry that's, you know, just hasn't always been the best at change takes time, right? And it's not a negative thing. It's just, I think it's just the situation, right?
I think that it's interesting you should say that, and we're saying about fiber reinforced plastics, because I've been involved in cavity wall ties in the UK since 1985. And when it first came about, you'll appreciate this, was when it first came about doing cavity wall ties, we didn't have metal detectors. And this engineer said, can you go put some wall ties in that wall, but want you to find the old ones? Huh? So, okay, off we go. So what we did is we took some bricks out, because it was a masonry veneer, two wires thick in the UK. And we actually got a flashlight and a mirror so that we could look up and say, there's a tie there, two bricks to the left, so that we could take a brick out and remove it because it was expanding and corroding, and put another wall tie in next to it. And then eventually we did get the actual metal detectors to start locating these areas to tie this back. But in the UK, what we found was that with our wall ties, we only had 275 grams per meter square on the wall tie, and it wasn't enough galvanization coating. So in the UK now, it's 950 grams per meter square or stainless steel. Do you think that eventually they'll change to stainless steel in America rather than go with these galvanized strips? Which, by the way, I found corroding at a very early age.
And, you know, and to like I said earlier, tell you the truth, like, so masonry and that aspect, it's not my specialty, because most of the time when we're dealing with, like, we're going to deal with like a veneer system, like it might be on the stair tower of a garage.
Yeah.
Rarely do you, at least in my experience, it's not something we run across for the facade as much. But, you know, to your point, right, like, it's just change, right? And it's convincing all of the stakeholders that something needs to change. And here's a good one for you, Alan, that I know we've talked about, are inspection laws, right?
Yes.
So we track inspection laws across the country as it relates to our structure, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in structure of in inspection of parking structures, either have their own laws in select jurisdictions. In others, they just happen to fall under a facade or exterior walls. And I think we both know the answer to this, but how do these inspection laws come out? It's usually because something happened, something collapsed.
Right. Something dire. Yeah, something dire and on national TV.
That's, and unfortunately, that's how most, not all, because I actually, there's a suburb that makes me, you know, I can walk there. They actually enacted it proactively. Nothing happened in this jurisdiction. They just saw what happened in Surfside and say, hey, we're getting all of these garages inspected, right? That's not, I would say, common, but it does happen. But for the most part, yeah, something catastrophic, made national news. It's a, oh crap, we have something.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, I recently wrote that there are no masonry veneer inspections in America, although it is down the line hopefully going to change. But one of the things that we recently gave a presentation, myself and Mike Schuler, at the World of Concrete, and we've mentioned this before at Structural Engineers Association in Texas, that there are no specific historic masonry restoration codes in America. Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, that you pointed out before that a building that's not inspected with a defect could be just as dangerous as an 18-wheeler with a steering defect, because when that masonry comes down, it comes down. But I'm surprised that there's not more historic buildings when we go back. If something's 100 years old, especially if it's your granny, you're going to inspect it.
So that's the logic, I think, behind these facade and exterior wall inspection orders. Now, there's an ASTM that a lot of these are based off. And again, I'm no facade or exterior wall expert. So then my next question is, in terms of masonry, particularly historic, to what extent does the wall cavity and all the related components inspected? For some, that at least, you know, that I personally worked on, it just starts with, it's a visual inspection from the exterior, right? That's all you can see. How do you truly know? And other garage inspections that I worked with don't require a detailed inspection beyond visual, unless the engineer says, hey, I'm seeing something on the visual inspection that's triggering me to say move to the next phase, whether it's inspection openings, non-destructive testing, whatever case may be. But, you know, how do you know if some of these problems are just hiding in plain sight?
Well, I think that one of the main things for me is that I've been heavily involved in Texas with the downtown squares. When you're dealing with a lot of these old buildings specifically, you're dealing with cobbled brickwork. Now, the cobbled brickwork is sitting up on I-beams. It's sat there. In the old days, they used to send away for these pieces to Chicago to be delivered, and then the local masons put the I-beams, the front stanchions, everything else together to hold it and put it back together. But the trouble is that with the parapet walls, with it being cobbled, it's leaning, it's drawing forward, it's leaning forward. And the thing is there's no joists. The joists are running parallel to the back, so there's not much strapping to hold that back in place. Now, one thing that I was laughing at was, we was talking about tech and innovation. Eventually, like, you've got Google Drive and you can go downtown and you can look around the square on a Google Drive. Wouldn't it be interesting if they did it with a Google drone? Because if the Google drone could go down the square in a square and literally be able to 3D flare and things and see that in 3D, I think it'd give it a much more better interpretation of a leaning building, which would then be able to be cost-effective method for the city and the inspectors down the line. I know I'm sort of dreaming and hoping in a perfect world that it'll be great, but if we don't dream like that, we're never going to get it all done, you know? Because when what happens is like with me, I go to small towns, and some of them can be ghost towns with 900-700 people, 500 people, and some of the disrepair of the towns, they just don't have the money to put them back, but you still try to share all that knowledge that you can. It's same with you, with older buildings and different communities. You've got to share that professional knowledge, haven't you?
Absolutely. And one of, I think, the big pieces of innovation and technology is being able to do more with the same amount of people, particularly those who, like we said, we're not getting the same influx of, you know, these 30-year plus professionals with experience in, you know, historic and frankly unpredictable structures, right?
Yeah.
Especially if they, you know, the way they were designed and the assumptions we made back when those structures were built are, you know, different from the codes we enact and how we design today, right? So it's a lot of this tribal knowledge is not anymore, right? So if I can equip those people to do less of tedious busy work and focus on what they do best, I think that's a win.
Yeah, I do. And it's interesting to see how all the historic concrete comes into play in about the 1900s and how it changes and investigations. And so I'm excited about all that. In the future, I do think that with a lot of repair strategies, things will change and it'll become more of a standard operational procedure, a bit more with the the information shared, because we're still dealing, when we go back to almost the 60s, 70s, 80s mentality of inspection techniques. The book's been rewritten slowly but surely, but it certainly is, within the construction game, a slow burn, you might say.
And Alan, you know, I think it's a game of incentives, right?
Yep.
And you have to ask, you know, if historic masonry buildings started falling over tomorrow,
yep,
you know, just and it just kept making the news, how, like, what would the incentive be for the leaders in our country, right?
Yeah.
Like, take the National Bridge inspection program by the FHWA.
Right? Yeah, good one, yeah.
Well, how did that come about? It's because we had a number of high profile and serious failures in the bridge world, and it mandated inspection at minimum intervals of 2 years, right, biennial. So there was someone or some group of leadership that was incentivized to say, we can't let this happen. We need to get eyes on this. We need to, you know, have a program to have these issues identified before they become major problems, right? And, mm-hmm, you know, Fern Hollow in Pittsburgh, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, when former past President Biden was down, that's not normal. That doesn't happen every day. It just happened to be a high profile in the news. So you're starting to see influxes of these cities, whether it be facade and exterior wall, parapet, parking garage, that are seeing these problems, right? Going, oh crap, I got to do something. And now they have an incentive to pass a law. Do we need federal laws around inspection of parking garages, historic masonry, old buildings? I mean, I'm not a politician, I'm not a lawmaker, but there's definitely danger lurking out there. And I think everyone's to be informed of the risks that accompany that.
There you go. You couldn't have put it better, Nick. You couldn't have put it better, mate. Exactly. And I think that's a very professional way of looking at it. And I hope that a lot more people adopt these philosophies and realize that we are on the cusp of change. We are trying to utilize all equipment and get that there. Oh, by the way, on a personal note, did you get a drone?
Absolutely. Yeah, we
because you were looking at it and I just wondered what your opinion is, because until you learn how to fly it, which I was lucky, I learned to fly mine on Ghost Recon on Xbox. So I became naturally at it. But for you and your staff and the pictures, do you think it's a game changer that you can get to the places where you couldn't before? Because one of the things is that I went on an historic building. This is a story that I told at the World of Concrete. So I went on an 1890s building about 15 years ago. And to get up and inspect 7 chimneys, we had to rent a 60-foot boom lift. We had to get all the matting down. We had to get the boom lift into place, get a crew into place. Total cost of about $7,000. The customer phones me up about 15 years later and said, we bought a new house, 1890. It's got 5 chimneys. Can you come and have a look at it? And I thought, I ain't going through all that again. So I went down with my drone, and luckily enough, I was able to get up there, visually see 5 chimneys in severe disrepair from the 1890s without causing any disruption, without me having to get up there and everything else for a small amount. But the quality of the pictures and the information gained was paramount, because one of the chimneys was leaning really badly and a strong wind, it had come right through the roof. So
I think it depends what your use case is. So in the garage world, they are definitely useful, but I would say less useful than let's say buildings and bridges. And I say that because in an open air above radar structure, so from the interior, you can pretty much reach most of these garages, like 10 foot floor to floor, right? So you get a 6 foot ladder or even a step stool, you can get up close to pretty much everything on the inside, right?
Fair point, yeah.
For the exterior, right, that first level you've got pretty good eyes on, and then if you really want to get up close, like these, you know, these exterior spandrels that high, you can just pop up to the closest level and stick your head out, right? So I'm not saying they're not useful. I think it's just about knowing your use case, and in your use case is 5 chimneys, right?
Yes.
I bet what I tell people specifically for drones is let them be your reconnaissance, right? Before you send a rope access team or get a man lift or build scaffolding, just, you know, you can fly a $300 drone up there, get some really detailed photos, and then let that be your recon. We're not saying to let that replace the hands-on inspection. We're just saying focus your hands-on inspection and inform it using the data that you learn. Can you reduce the number of drops? Can you reduce the number of scaffolding? Can you reduce the on-site time of the boom? For the most part, yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think you got that, again, some great points. And as you said, it's all in the applications. It's working out. It's new tech, new this. But also as well, one of the things that we're getting more and more, especially with higher, bigger buildings, we're finding access that we can get robots to climb up the side of the building to get us a much better bird's eye view. and cost-effective, time-saving in some instances. But I think that the main thing to get across is, as you said, out of all them points, it gives you a chance with a drone to warrant further investigation. And the more information we can get, the more information the command decisions can be made and the customers made well aware of the situational awareness.
And another great thing about drones is the way it helps you communicate your results. So for example, at this house, you can fly up a drone relatively quickly using photogrammetry. You can make a 3D model, and instead of trying to discuss the results with a client through a paper port, you know, or in addition to a paper port, you can just pull up the 3D model and go click on the photos and say, hey, instead of me saying the northwest corner of the third of five chimneys, it's just like, click, here's the photo, right? Here's a spall, here's a crack. Look at this way, it started to lean. And I think it makes it easier to communicate to your client what's going on in a way they understand.
I'm looking forward to the advancements in the CAD department, whereas then it can show you in 3D, but it also as well, my point of view, because I deal a lot with constraint anchors and specialized anchors, drilled anchors, that it explains to the customer more where these anchors are going to be installed so that they've got an image, because there's a lot of times I've got to sit down with my clients after an engineer's report has been issued and walk them through the practicalities of it, because most people, they're not used to seeing it. It's like when you go to the doctors and they give you this big old report. So what's wrong? You've got a bad knee. Oh, well, there's 14 pages there.
here's an example for, let's just take, you know, brick CMU backup wall ties, very simple example.
Yes.
Today, we can use photogrammetry with a drone to get you a nice big stitched image of a wall, right? Like you'll be able to see hairline cracks. Like you get fine. Now the next question is, okay, how do I see the layer behind that wall, right? It is in the near future. Can I get a robot to crawl with non-destructive test equipment, locate all of my wall ties, place them exactly where they are on the wall, and tell me the relative condition, let's say if they're galvanized and like the, let's say like the health score, like maybe it's like a score out of 100, this wall tie is a 36, this one's a 74, right? And I'm just, this is just all high level, right? But the idea being we clearly communicate the results of our investigations in a way our clients understand. I think the answer is yes, it just requires, I think, a shift in thinking by the leaders in our industry.
Yeah, it's on both sides, I can see it, because you're dealing, when you're dealing a lot of, on your investigation, as you said, a lot of the ceilings are high and things like this. We've got different rebar locators, things like that, Hilti models. I got involved in the old Brodeville back in its day. And the guy that invented the metal detector, as I said, was between stainless steel and mild steel heads on the end. And also as well, I had a CM42, which would tell me the size of the rebar in the concrete and things like this. More and more, that's starting to come together, and more they can see the mesh patterns and things, as you said, in CMU walls, and locate these defects, which are helping us to repair. Because down the line, there's a lot of buildings out there that are going to need repair, and all the technology, all the wisdom, all of the training that we've been put into effect are certainly going to be tested down the line. And then it's going to be tested to see if we can get the contractors on board to come up to speed, because as well as it's a big step. It's a big step for the contractor to move in these fields. But then again, saying that, same as your phone, think of all that. We take these on site every day, so they're certainly an asset, and being able to get the pictures to the contractors and people like that and reports quicker and faster than it used to is certainly an asset.
Absolutely. And you know, from our experience, actually what we do in terms of technology is the interior of it and the exterior. We actually take Google Street Light photos, and we have them tied to every lamp. So if there's ever a question about what did I see in this garage and this site visit, you just hop back into the panos, and you've got full 360 imagery on it. Is it perfect? Is it exactly like being on site? Now, nothing ever replaces being face-to-face with structure, right? But for the cost and the time, you know, it's pretty good. And instead of recalling from your memory or trying to look at, I wish I would have just turned the camera another 5 inches this way to see, just hop back in and do the best you can.
Well, there's one for you that I was laughing at the other day is I'm waiting to see that Matterport put one on a drone.
So they exist today. So you can actually take a 360 camera on a drone. You can fly it up. And like you said, you can go to the downtown square and you can get 360 photos in the air.
And that's what we need. And the thing is down the line, I'm hoping that, I keep going on about AI and its advantages and disadvantages, but I am hoping that it makes understanding defects of these these small towns that's been shrouded for the last 100 years, really, because, you know, you're talking about maintenance and things. My rule of thumb is this, is that mortar's designed to be sacrificial to the brick. And in my opinion, mortar should be inspected every 25 years to keep the rain shield intact. You know, as you know in your game, there's three things that affect garages, masonry. There's three things that affect it totally. Water, water, and water. Mm-hmm. So the more information we can get and deflect all that and put it all together, the more that we can come up with a plan.
Absolutely. And then, right, in the case of both masonry and concrete, right, it's that pesky little salt that dissolves, and you get water-laden, chloride-laden water. That's even worse.
Well, it certainly is in masonry, because one of the things is with old historic buildings, rising damp, it's got old brick footings, and rising damp usually comes up to about a height of 3 feet. People say, why a height of 3 feet? Well, because then gravity takes over. But if it's got a capillary action, it's amazing how water can actually migrate through a building and cause problems on rail. Roofing, guttering, foundation, all of the above that we have to deal with. But certainly, I think that water, water, and water is certainly the big enemy. But it's scary in some ways, because one of the things, I don't know about me, but are you for painting parking garages? Because I'm certainly not for painting historic masonry or
metal. So we got to talk about paint versus coatings, right?
There we go. Now then, go
on. So we talk about, personally, I'm an engineer, right? I'd make every building look like a box if I could, right? The most efficient way.
Well done.
we live in a house that's brick, and I'd have to go back to my photos, but we did a bathroom renovation, poured the exterior wall, right? And you can see the brick and the CMU backup. I see painted brick all throughout my neighborhood, and I like look and I'm like, it's hard enough on a commercial project to get a specifier who like knows the ins and outs. There's some guy in a truck. Yeah, I'll slap some paint on your chimney, make it look good. 2 years later, it's starting to peel and bubble. It wasn't the right product. And there's a difference between coatings, and there's different coatings, what they do. So to answer your question, I like it all natural. I think, if you want a certain color or a certain look, just make sure whoever you're working with understands the product being applied, because if they don't, whoops.
Well, for me, I've seen a lot of historic buildings fall into disrepair very, very quickly because they painted the outside. It looks great when they first do it and they take the picture and they want tourists to come. But leave it another 5 years when it's blistered and caused all that water inside to actually bubble up and hot, cold, and interstitial condensation.
Yeah, and just understanding, what is the wall system trying to accomplish, right? Is it truly a barrier, right? Is it a screen? We have weeps and water has a way to get out. And that informs your decision to do whatever you're going to do to that system, right? It's just like structural response, right? We have a system. We know there's going to be loads of those. What's the structural response, right?
Yes.
Okay, I didn't even go to say, right? So like structural engineering and building enclosures go hand in hand. Structural engineering, you're trying to find a way to get load from one place to another. In a building enclosure, you're trying to figure out how to get water from one place to another, both without causing problems, right?
Yep.
There's a little more nuance to it. Don't get me wrong, but it's kind of the basic idea, right? That's how I explain it, at least.
But it really is. And I'm so happy today that we was able to sit down and have a chat. And I think that down the line, we'll be getting together and having another chat as it goes on, especially about from my side, wall tying, anchors, stabilization, your side, I think a bit more. But to be honest with you, I can't thank you enough for coming on the show and us having a chit chat and discussing the two different things between masonry and concrete and garages, but has still been aware of everything that's going on around us, because it's moving at such a fast pace, and sharing the knowledge and on LinkedIn and things like this. I hope you keep up the good posts. Me and Jill tried to keep up some different posts to certainly keep a different view of it. But I do appreciate you've been around, Nick, and I do appreciate you've been there as a knowledgeable person that'll share that wisdom and help people out. So I really appreciate you being on today, and thanks a lot, mate. And I look forward to us talking just in general down the line, because I think we've got a good bit to share between us that we can share with other people. And the more knowledge we share, hopefully less mistakes are made and we can make a difference. Eh?
Absolutely. My pleasure, Alan. This has been fantastic. Yeah, and I'll look forward to the next time we're able to get together. Thank you so much.
So will I. Thank you so much, Nick, and have a wonderful day, and I look forward to talking to you again, my friend. Thank you.
Likewise, Alan. Until next time.
Thank you. Bye now.